Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So if you've been following the site for a while, you probably are familiar with Matt Moore. He is our resident chef on theartofmanliness.com. He's written the lion's share of the cooking content on our site, and he's done stuff about it, how to make your homemade pasta, how to make gumbo, how to make chili, how to cook with wild game, all sorts of great stuff. And the thing I love about Matt is he makes cooking approachable. And it's not intimidating. And it's one of the reasons I love publishing this content on our site. Anyways, Matt's got a new book out. It's a big deal. It's with Southern Living Magazine. It's called A Southern Gentleman's Kitchen, Adventures in Cooking, Eating, and Living in the New South. And today on the show, we're going to talk about Matt's really interesting background because he didn't start off being a cookbook writer. In fact, he started out as a musician. In addition to this cookbook thing, he also has a cologne company that he runs with his friends. It's called Moonshine Cologne. He's done some other stuff too. It's my favorite cologne. Really interesting guy, really interesting backgrounds. We're going to talk about entrepreneurship. Then we're going to talk about why a man should know how to cook. We're going to talk about his boar hunt from a helicopter and cooking that boar that he killed. And we're also going to discuss the intricacies and the finer points of cooking the perfect steak. Really fun podcast with some really great takeaways as well. I think you're going to like this. So without further ado, Mr. Matt Moore. Matt Moore, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. You know, for many, many years, it's only been me writing, so
yeah,
I get a chance to like ponder over every little word, and now I might have to preface this, and if I say something stupid, I apologize.
No, I know how it goes, man. So for those of you who don't read the website regularly and just a podcast listener, Matt has been, how long have you been writing cooking content for us?
We've been writing together for, I believe, just around 5 years.
Yeah. That's great. How did we connect? You reached out to me about your first cookbook, right?
I did. Yeah. A buddy of mine had emailed me on Facebook at the time that I had just launched the first book, Have Her Over for Dinner. And he was actually living in Hawaii at the time. And he said, hey man, you know, I've come across this blog. I think it's a great fit. You should reach out to him and see if you could do a guest post. And I remember emailing you, and you got back with me pretty quickly, and I had pitched you on the whole idea of guys cooking for girls, and we just kind of started our relationship there through the internet. We met on the internet.
We met on the internet. That's how it goes these days. So let's start talking about your history, because you have an interesting background story, right?
Sure.
So you just came with your new book, A Southern Gentleman's Kitchen, done with Southern Living Magazine. Big deal. And then you did the cookbook, Have Her Over for Dinner. We'll talk about how you self-published that. But like, was becoming like an expert like cookbook writer, was that your initial goal when you started out your adult life?
Or absolutely not.
Okay. So how did that happen?
What a long, strange trip it's been. You know, for me, I was really fortunate. Grew up just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Really, really active in sports. Some of my friends have gone on to play in the major leagues and football and baseball. And for many, many years, I thought that I was, you know, destined to become the next great baseball player. But some injuries came along, and I probably wasn't good enough in the first place. You know, let's not kid ourselves here. And I went to the University of Georgia, and my second love was always music. So I was in a band for about 6 years, four of those through college, where we toured all over the Southeast and much of the East Coast. And then I had a dream that I wanted to be in Nashville, Tennessee. Came to Nashville, our band was ready to go and hit the road, and then the band broke up. And I remember at that time when I had moved to Nashville, I reached out to a friend of mine. It was the only guy that I knew here in town. He was a songwriter. He was the creative director of EMI Music Publishing. And I'll never forget it. I sent him an email. I said, hey, Bruce, you know, I finally made it to Nashville, Tennessee. The band broke up, but I'm here. Can't wait to do it. And he said, you know what, Matt, that's great. He said, it's a 10-year town. He said, the problem is I just moved back down to Athens, Georgia to start the music department for the University of Georgia, which is where I had gone to school. So you often hear that many, many times when it comes to Nashville and how long the process can be in the music world. And I kind of count myself fortunate in the sense that my first few years were really fun. I got to go out and do a lot of great things as a musician and as a performer, and a lot of the guys that I know that I featured in this book that are near and dear to my heart are now at the top of the country music charts. But to be honest with you, Brett, I really kind of lost my passion for for music. It really wasn't something that I had my heart into. And I really loved writing. I loved teaching guys about some of the experiences that I had grown up with food. And that all started from playing music. We would go down to New Orleans and play shows all over the state of Georgia. And we'd bring back all this great food and throw big parties. And I kind of had this idea of sorts at that time that maybe writing a cookbook was a bit of a good idea. And that's really a crazy path that led me into this whole world of food.
Okay. And your first cookbook was self-published, right?
It was. I had a buddy of mine who was working for one of the artist agencies, CAA, here in town. And I had told him, hey, man, you know, I think I'm going to write a cookbook. And at the time, he was like, man, that's a great idea. He was a young agent in the music business. He never liked my music, but all of a sudden he liked this cookbook idea. And we still laugh about it to this day. So I kind of put together a book proposal, and he flew out on a plane to Los Angeles to meet with the creative folks at Creative Artist Agency. And the first thing they said was like, well, this is real cute. Like, I mean, your friend doesn't have a platform. He doesn't have a popular blog. He's not a celebrity. Like, you know, why in the world would you ever think, A, that we'd be interested in signing this guy? B, he's not a chef, so why does he want to write a cookbook? And C, they kind of made a joke to him. They said, all of our publishing department is based in New York and not L.A. So we found out pretty quickly that, I say it to no avail, we were so green back then that we just didn't know any better, which led me down the road of getting 1,000 no's from basically every agent and every publisher in New York, which led me to the self-publishing process.
And what was great about it, though, it was a hit. Like, the New York Times called it one of the best cookbooks of, when was this published? I think it was like...
Yeah, that was in 2011.
Okay.
But that was a long road. You know, right now, the idea for books and even, you know, music and albums and business, I think we have this tendency that when it launches, it's like, that's our opportunity to seize the moment, and you've got to build up this huge bit of momentum. Your business has to get this much funding, or your album has to sell this many copies, or your book has to do this, that, or the other. For me, you know, coming out of the music business, especially the independent music business, I kind of just started to pepper and build a little bit of a following here in Nashville, and then just outside of Atlanta where I was from. And it was a slow build. It was reaching out to folks like yourself that were starting out building blogs and trying to spread the word organically. So, quote unquote, saying it was a success, to be honest with you, I was probably 8 to 10 months in post book launch, and it was a fun period in my life. You know, I put up some money and scratched up what I had and kind of went out and started promoting it and knocking on a ton of doors. And, it wasn't like, you know, the New York Times just got a copy and all of a sudden said this is, you know, one of the year's best cookbooks. It took a ton of work, and I'd say even more rejection. Oftentimes people, you know, see a story like mine and they're like, man, I could never do that. But it's a marathon. You know, it's something that you have to wake up. And I like to say every day, I think we wrote an article about this back then, that my goal every day, whether it's in business or anything creative, is that I want to wake up every day and hear the word no 100 times. And if I hear that many times, it tells me that I'm pitching hard enough, because not everyone's going to like what you do. Mm-hmm. But I also know that the more and more of those that you queue up, you're going to start to get some yeses. And it's hard to hear the word no and for folks not to maybe like your ideas or what you're doing. But if you're constantly afraid and you're never putting something out there, you're actually just never going to grow or get anywhere. And that was a lesson that I learned by self-publishing that book. And I have to attribute a lot of the later success to those early lessons that I learned.
Well, how do you get over that fear of rejection? Is it just a matter of exposing yourself to it as much as you can, where you just sort of become desensitized to it? Or do you engage any sort of like mindset work to help you like bone, you know, steel yourself up for the rejection? Or is it just a matter of you just get used to it?
You know, it's like my favorite Pink Floyd song, Comfortably Numb. I'd say especially in the creative space, if you're a writer or you're in music, you're a chef, it's tough. You know, when people don't like what you do, even as an entrepreneur, it almost feels personal. For me, I think that one of the biggest strengths that you can have if you're interested in that space is to very quickly get over that. You know, value people's opinions. I think I've been told no on a lot of ideas that I did not end up pursuing. And in hindsight, I'm glad that I was told the word no. And I'm glad it gave me pause to maybe reconsider or adapt or change. I mean, even like when I turn in, you know, an article for you that you don't feel like is on point, oftentimes that's a good chance for me to go back and reconsider what I'm trying to do. At the same time, you know, you can be super passionate. And yeah. I like to sometimes use the word no as kind of more fuel to the fire. Those words that keep coming up and rejections just kind of provide me with a little bit more ammunition to keep pursuing and being persistent and being even more determined to make sure that I'm doing everything possible to go out and achieve my goals.
Awesome. So before we get more into cooking, we got to bring up the fact that the cooking thing, the music, isn't the only thing you've done. You've also, along with a group of your friends, started a cologne company. The reason I bring that up is because I'm in my closet right now, and there's a bottle of moonshine looking at me. And if you guys haven't checked
don't
this stuff out,
it.
No, don't drink it. No, that would kill you.
You're a former attorney, so you can see that we basically put that on every part of the box.
But no, it smells fantastic. It's my favorite cologne. So how did that happen, right? Did this happen, like, was this a plan for a long time, or did this happen just at a spur of the moment thing? How did you end up becoming or creating a cologne fragrance company?
You know, I think this is the important lesson that I want all the listeners to take away, is you really never know where your path is going to lead, right? I think we can always try to make plans or study a certain venture and try to force things down a certain path. But if you pull anything from my story, hopefully it's like you never know what opportunity is going to lead you into the next one. So I went to the University of Georgia, really wasn't sure what I wanted to study. My parents told me to study business. So I ended up getting a degree in international finance and French. I really liked this girl that was in my French class throughout college, and that's why I pursued it so heavily. But then, you know, you heard the backstory of moving to Nashville and doing the cookbook. And then I hit this phase where even though I'd had, a bit of success, critical success in the food writing world, I had this idea for the book that we just now have published 5 years later. And still, even with, you know, the New York Times and all the cool things that that led to, could not find a home for the book. And so I kind of was a little bit disenfranchised. Just wanted to take a little bit of a bit of time off, if you will. I was tired of hearing the word no. And I was on a long run one day, and oftentimes that's kind of my creative space, is to go out for a long run and just kind of let my mind wander. And a buddy of mine that I went to college with was actually doing some male modeling, and trust me, we gave him a hard time for that, for some brands where basically they were taking like polo shirts, and instead of it being a horse, they were putting, I don't know, like some other icon on it and repackaging it and calling it a Southern brand and selling it. And it seemed to be a successful venture. And I had another partner of mine that was a good friend. He's an attorney, and I kind of pitched him the idea. I was like, man, I've never really known anything about fragrance, but in the same way that I thought the cookbook publishing world was this antiquated world that was so driven by celebrity and hype, I thought that the name Moonshine Cologne would really reverberate very well with, like, what I grew up with. Good old boys from the South, a lot of fraternity guys in college that maybe had never worn fragrance because they didn't want Justin Bieber to tell them what they wanted to smell like. So we just kind of stumbled onto it. It was one of those things that we're like, you know what, we're good friends. This would be a cool business opportunity. And at the worst case scenario, we're going to have great Christmas presents for, you know, our friends and family for the next 3 years. Now, again, being that green, because we were just that green, I mean, the fragrance business is this crazy complicated business that's really managed throughout Europe and the world. The United States is actually 7th. In the world in terms of per capita spending on fragrance. So we launched in like the least profitable market. We had to do a lot of international partnerships. And in hindsight, my parents are very happy because I'm finally using my degree in international business and speaking French with a lot of partners over there. But we saw a void in the marketplace. And I think the big lesson learned is that we were maybe a little bit green and didn't know enough about it, but we weren't fazed by the major brands and the major players, and we put our money where our mouth was. It was a smaller investment. I think oftentimes when people are looking at starting companies, especially if they've come from the corporate world or they've come from a world where they're not floating the startup capital, they think right on, you know, we need a brand manager, a graphic designer, and a publicist and all these things. We did everything ourselves. And even to this day, we still do everything to ourselves. And that could be a fault based on the size of the company that we've grown. But we just work our tail off every day. So it came about very naturally and organically. And we've even told a story on your site from starting out in my friend's parents' basement, you know, hand bottling this fragrance and picking up the phone and calling stores throughout the country and literally selling it store by store. It's just waking up and taking that, you know, first step forward every single day. And we built it to a successful company. And you know, I think there's a lot of luck. We're very humbled by it. We're very grateful for it. But even as we've matured as a company, we've realized that we've got to continue to nurture it and grow it and, you know, always keep it at the forefront that if you don't pay attention to it, then, you know, a lot of those blessings that we receive from our hard work will go away.
All right. So let's talk cooking here. So you've sort of made it your mission in life to not just write about cooking, but write it geared towards men. Why is that? I mean, what is it? Why are a lot of men apprehensive about cooking in the first place?
You know, you're right. It is kind of a mission statement for me. Growing up, I was fortunate to be in a home where every night, whether I came home from football or baseball practice, my father not only said, hey, you got to get your homework done, you got to clean the kitchen, but you're also going to help mom out and be there as well. So I, you know, attribute a lot of the strength of my family and the relationships that we have and a lot of my upbringing to the nightly ritual of sitting around with my family, not playing on the phone, not watching TV, not at the neighborhood restaurant, but just sitting down and having a family meal. When I got to college and beyond, I kind of realized that men and women, for that matter, didn't really have the same experience that I had. You know, a lot of the meals were outsourced to the local restaurant, or there's a lot of distractions. And the central idea of cooking, really nobody knew how to cook. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, most people don't think men know how to cook, but it really was true for that generation because it just wasn't a common thing that they saw in the household. For me, I found a lot of joy in teaching others what I had learned from family experiences. But I also came to find that I believe that men can become better men in the strangest of all places, which is the kitchen. And that's much of the subject of all the articles that I write for you. I like to tell stories about, you know, what the end goal is. It's not just a fried chicken recipe, but it's a chance for you to try something new. It's a chance for you to take on a bit of risk, a little bit of adventure. And then also the satisfaction that can result from, you know, doing something that you've never done before, you've never had experience in doing. And I think the niche that a lot of folks have left out and what's been my strong suit is making cooking super approachable.
Yeah.
You know, you turn on the TV, you watch Top Chef, you watch Chopped. I mean, these are pretty amazing shows, but, you know, nobody even knows how to boil water that's watching these shows, yet they could discern to me and critique the flambé style. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous to me. So instead, what I wanted to do within my food writing is always really be careful to keep things as simple as possible, make it as approachable as possible, make it affordable. If I'm trying to tell somebody to skip the restaurant down the street and make something at home, I want them to spend less making it at home than they do just going out to eat. And that's often a really tough thing, especially if they're single guys or young couples. You know, if I told you to make fajitas in your house and you wanted steak and chicken and shrimp and guacamole and sour cream and cheese and everything else, I'd say, you know what, go down to the local restaurant because you'll never make it cheaper than what you can buy it for. So I'm always trying to tailor that for my audience and invite people into the kitchen and show them that it is something that they can do.
Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to, you know, set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we've loved having you write articles for the site, is that you do make it approachable. Like even for me, I'm somewhat in, like my go-to meals for when it's my turn to cook, it's like hot dogs, hamburgers, chili, you know, just like eggs and pancakes. But nothing wrong with that. Good stuff. But like whenever you publish an article or just flipping through the book, The Southern Gentleman's Kitchen, I look at these stuff and I'm like, I could do that. Right. And even though it looks amazing, like it looks like it's something that you have to be a 5-star chef to know how to do. You look at the prep and the recipe, the ingredients, and you're like, wow, that's actually not that hard.
Yeah. And that's a big philosophy for me. I always am really conscious about the ingredients that I'm using, the techniques that I'm using. And let's get real, cooking, is it something that you're just going to wake up one day and follow a recipe and it's just going to be ta-da, everything's perfect? There's nuances of learning, and you can follow the written recipe to the T. And that's one of the things I love about cookbooks, especially the one that we just did, is it was tested so many times that you should be able to follow it exactly and get the results that it should yield. But at the same time, it is a learning process. I didn't just automatically, after cooking hundreds of meals with my mom, leave and go out and start to become this wizard in the kitchen. I had to burn some steaks. I had to overcook some things. I had to make a lot of mistakes until I really learned how to perfect certain dishes or come up with just kind of a base of knowledge. And so that's my biggest thing, is whether or not you ever cook a recipe out of there, I just want to intrigue folks that it is something that they can do. It's a lifelong learning process. We talked the other week about intellectual curiosity, and it's like this never-ending search to be knowledgeable. And cooking is one of those rare things that, whether it's different types of cuisine, like smoking barbecue, to the ramen trend that's going on, to the perfect taco, to the perfect chili and hot dog, you can constantly, evolve and keep learning from those things and utilizing different ingredients. So it's just such a cool place that people often forget about, because I think it's just like a necessity. Like, I got to eat dinner. I want folks to find some joy in that and also realize that they're improving themselves by actually cooking that dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I love seeing on the Instagram, our Instagram feed, is like when people share the food that they made inspired by your post.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like guys who never really, I never cooked before, but I gave this a go. And
yeah,
it was awesome. It was something they did with their, like the noodle. You showed us how to make like homemade noodles, spaghetti.
Yeah.
I had so many, people showing like, pictures like here, I was doing this with my daughter, I was doing this with my wife. I mean, that's one of the great things about cooking at home, is that it's a great way. It's not just about the food. It's about the camaraderie and the fellowship that goes along with it.
Absolutely. Being born and raised in the South, I think one of our greatest attributes is hospitality and generosity, you know. In fact, my wife and I are expecting our first here later this week, and I've already got a train of friends saying, you know, what can we bring you in on what day? And they're doing it by bringing you food.
Yeah.
It's just a really, really simple, old, tried and true tradition that we share throughout the United States. It's not just something that goes on in the South. You know, for me, I like to, and as I often talk about, I enjoy at the end of the day maybe having a glass of wine or a bourbon on the rocks. And it's my chance. When I cook, it's actually like this great form of relaxation. One of my favorite things, going back into history and into time, you know, one of the problems when the assembly line came out, the old Ford plants, was they found that workers were so disenfranchised in that process because they were basically just like a number on the blocks that were putting together a car, and they never had the satisfaction of saying, like, you know what, I built that. For me, cooking is one of those rare things that within 30 minutes, you can start with all these raw ingredients, and then 30 minutes later end up with this meal that not only you're enjoying, but that you're providing to maybe your partner or to the rest of your family. And it's like, man, I conceptualized, like I executed, and I enjoyed this one thing all in this 30-minute period. And I know that a lot of guys, you know, especially young in your career, you don't feel like you're making an impact. For me, cooking was one of those things that kind of allowed me to kind of justify to a certain extent or find a bit of satisfaction in what I was doing that I think a lot of people are crying out for.
It's awesome. So the book, A Southern Gentleman's Kitchen, it's all about Southern cuisine. And that's sort of a risky topic to take on because I'm in Oklahoma. Oklahoma's kind of weird. I don't know if I'm in the South or the Midwest or the West. We've been labeled all sorts of things, but I do know that Southerners take their Southern food extremely serious. And if you mess it up, they'll just jump on you.
Sure.
How did you approach this book? Did you want to stay true to the tradition? Did you add any innovations to it? I mean, what was your approach to the book and as far as how you were going to present the recipes?
You know, man, I'll be honest. I'm going to give you a shout out and a shout out to all your listeners and to your readers. Writing on your site actually, I think, really prepped me to write a book like this. And you and I have tackled some pretty tall subjects, you know, the perfect chili,
yeah,
to the perfect way to roast a chicken.
The gumbo one.
And what's that?
The gumbo. That was,
oh, the gumbo.
You were nervous about that one. You were really nervous about that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever you say that you're going to make the perfect gumbo, it's a tall order. But, you know, that being said, I think what's so awesome is that you've created a community for people to not only share like, oh yeah, that's exactly how I do it. Or, you know, you could never make gumbo and put tomatoes in it, or gumbo is only made this way. You know, I've probably become a little bit desensitized to some of the comments, and I'd say, you know, 99% of the time everything's super favorable and everybody's really happy to see, you know, us taking on these types of subjects. But when it came to Southern food, I'll tell you, one of the greatest things that my editor told me in the process is I think very early on in the book, I was trying to showcase everything that I knew about, let's just take like a pork shoulder. You know, you're going to smoke a pork shoulder. It's like, I, growing up and being fortunate to travel throughout the South, I know how they do it in Texas versus North Carolina versus Georgia versus Florida and everything else. And I was trying to, like, within 250 words, like, showcase that everybody does it differently, blah, 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 and, like, make sure that I covered all my bases.
Yeah.
And then gave my recipe. And she was like, you know, you're not even speaking in your own voice. Like, just say that this is the way you do it. And if people have a problem with it, then who cares? This is your book. I mean, this is your opportunity. People are going to realize that, you know, they may have some different changes and nuances to it, but people really want to hear what your style is. And that freed me up so, so much to say, like, hey, this is my lifestyle. This is what my family experiences has been. This is my South. I encourage you to take what I give you as a template and maybe add in a dash of this or that or the other. But this is my opportunity to showcase to you what my take on Southern cuisine has been, is right now, and will become in the future. So I really owe a lot of credit to her in that collaboration to kind of give me the confidence to speak in my own voice.
So one of the things I love about your cookbook is that it's like really nice to look at, right? So like cookbooks, there's a ton of cookbooks out there, right? There are cookbooks are a dime a dozen. And we have a lot in our kitchen, and most of them I don't even look at. But yours, like, I just want to pick it up. And I've had people come in because it's been laying on our kitchen counter, and there's like, this is the greatest. This looks great. And like the pictures are fantastic. Sure. But the other thing I love about it is that you weave in these stories that go along with the recipes.
Right.
Like one of my favorites was you talk about a boar hunt that you went on.
Yeah. Right.
And then you have a recipe for how to cook a boar. So tell us about that boar hunt. I mean, that's really big. I don't think a lot of people understand, like, pigs are a pest here in the South. Like, we got a ton of them here in Oklahoma. Tell us about the boar hunt.
Man, again, another one of those random moments where, like, life connections just work out to be this amazing experience. My wife was actually snowboarding out in Utah, and she met a gentleman with her friends. I was unfortunately not there. His name's Greg Arnett, and if anybody's ever worn or seen Arnett sunglasses, this is the guy. I mean, the guy is worth quite a bit of money, but you would actually never know it. And she was telling him all about my story and what we were doing, and he was like, man, Matt sounds like a cool guy, and this is kind of that Southern hospitality. He said, I own this 8,000-acre ranch in Florida. You guys should come down one weekend. He's a hunter. He loves to do adventure, and this would be a great place for you guys to do a photo shoot and, you know, just have a good time. And it was one of those things. It's like, careful what you wish for, bro. We're going to take you up on that offer. And, so we did. We went down and set a whole, 3-day weekend outside of, his ranch and outside of Orlando, Florida. And he also happens to be a helicopter pilot too. So we basically had like the greatest man weekend ever, like shooting bows and arrows, grilling every night, you know, taking the fan boat out, and all the while capturing this whole narrative of a really common ritual, if you will. It happened to be a wild boar hunt, but it could be deer hunting or turkey hunting. And what we got out of it, not only did we have the opportunity to actually harvest a boar and create that recipe and tell that story, but it was an experience that will forever be ingrained as one of the greatest things that I got to do from writing this book. Now, I know that you'll probably see like this cool picture of me hanging off a helicopter.
Yeah, you're jumping out of a helicopter with aviator shades.
Yeah, you know,
it was pretty cool looking.
I don't get to do that every Saturday. but it was one of those cool moments for me that even though we were capturing it and it was a first time experience for me, and it might have been a bit over the top, it was just a cool way for me to say, man, what an experience, what a journey. And it is something that people do, especially in Texas. You know, they actually fly in helicopters and shoot with AR-57.
Yeah.
We were actually flying into the land and then sitting there for 3 or 4 hours because the helicopter was so loud. But what I was trying to capture there, more importantly for the book, is adventure. You know, cooking is an adventure, and it doesn't matter if you are sitting in your kitchen or you're going to the farmer's market or you happen to be hanging out of a MD-800 helicopter. I've met so many guys that they can tell me the nuances, I mean, with pride about how they field dress a deer, yet the idea of them making an omelet in the morning doesn't sound manly enough. And I'll kind of poke at them. I'll be like, you know, like, actually you butchering and field dressing is just as cool and just as manly as you perfecting an omelet, which you and I have taken that subject on to.
Yeah.
So that was really what we wanted to get out of the whole boar hunt.
That's really cool. Yeah. And you've, and for those who are interested, there are other game recipes in here as well. And you've also written some recipes for wild game on the site. I think you had like venison chili. Which I think some people made and with great success. So check that out. Yeah, it's something that the boar hunt is something I want to do. I got a friend here in town who does it with pit bulls and knives. Like, that's all they do.
you've got me beat there, man.
Yeah.
I'll have to see some pictures of that.
We'll see how it goes down. Like, the pit bull, like, just like grabs the boar for you to, and then like it waits there for you to get there. And then you just take your knife and you just stab it in the heart, and then it's done. So
yeah, that sounds a little bit risky. Make sure you come up from behind.
Yeah, for sure. So Matt, I always like to end these shows with some practical takeaways, like something that a guy can do today to put into practice, like what we've been talking about. So, I mean, here's a question. If there's like one cooking project that a guy, any guy who's never really cooked ever before, and he's like, okay, I'm on the way home, I'm going to pick up some groceries and I'm going to try to make, is there like one thing that you think that any guy could do that isn't lame, like hot dogs, right?
Yeah.
But that's a little, involves a little work, and the payoff is awesome.
You know, it's funny you asked that question. We talk about flying helicopters, and one of the things that I'm working on right now is getting my pilot's license, which is an incredibly humbling experience. And I've got a guy here that's in his late 50s. He's been a pilot for 25 years, and he's been a great resource for me. Part of that was the deal. He takes me out when I'm not with my flight instructor so I can actually relax. He's like, you know, I've never learned how to cook, but what I want to really, 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 really get good at is cooking the perfect steak. He's like, so I'll take you up as much as you want to practice your flying and give you experience, but I want you to come over to my house and teach me how to cook several different cuts of steak in the perfect manner.
Okay.
And what's cool about that is it is so simple to cook a perfect steak. Okay. So that would be my challenge, and what it requires is just a couple of different things. It's going to require, number one, and you and I talk a lot about this, a cast iron pan.
Okay.
So I'm not recommending that your listeners go out and spend hundreds of dollars on cookware. This is something you can pick up in your hardware store. You can probably pick it up in any grocery store across America. It's going to cost you $25. Lodge cast iron, they season their skillets, they're ready to go. Then it comes to a cut of steak, and I think we've written everything from skirt steaks to fillets to flank steaks and everything between. But steaks are meant to be cooked extremely hot and extremely fast. So I like to use a bit of butter, which allows you to get a nice caramelization in the steak. I love to use just simply salt and pepper. And in a cast iron pan over high heat, get a great sear on the outside of the steak, give it a nice flip. Whether it needs to go in the oven based on the thickness of the steak or not, or if you're cooking it on an outside grill with cast iron on the grill, you cook it up to your temperature, whether it's mid-rare or medium. Hopefully it doesn't go beyond that point. and that's one of my favorite. If you can master that, and it's such like the classic man dish, but so many guys cook steaks so poorly, and all it requires is a little bit of technique, the right piece of equipment being cast iron, salt, and pepper. And if you can start there, then I think you can start to evolve into a lot of different great dishes.
Awesome. Is there a particular cut of steak that you think is pretty easy to work with?
You know, one of my favorite cuts, you know, obviously people talk about your ribeye steak, which I think is like the chef's choice steak. You know, filet mignon doesn't have enough fat, but it's super tender. I happen to be a really big skirt steak guy. For me, it's one of those cuts that you can typically find your butcher. You can get them to cut it a bit thicker. So that way, when I say thick, you don't want something that's super, super thin, because then by the time you get a nice sear on it, it's almost going to be cooked all the way through. Yeah. So if you can get something that's like an inch and a half thick, it's got enough fat, so you get all that great flavor like you get from a ribeye. But the way that it's cut, and when you serve it across the grain, super, super tender and tons of flavor. And what I love is, especially I knew when I was starting out, you know, it's affordable. You know, rather than paying like $20 a pound for a cut of steak, you can buy a skirt steak for less than $10 a pound anywhere in the country. And it's a really, really big payoff dish that I love to serve.
Awesome. I just cooked skirt steak for lunch.
Oh, yeah. Look at you, man.
It's great.
Goodness, you're eating better than I am.
Yeah. you know, it's another one of my favorite cuts that I've just gotten hip to is chuck eye steak.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, yeah, my butcher calls it, it's the poor man's ribeye.
Yeah.
And it's
for sure
delicious. It's super
good. My my grandfather was a butcher, and we talk a lot about that in the book, but that's one of the things that he would always reserve, like the chuck eye and the skirt steak and all these other alternative cuts, because that was his favorite. You know, that's what had the most flavor. And if you knew how to prepare it in the right manner, you know, that's the best way to do it. In fact, I've been really fortunate. When we talk about skirt steak, I do a lot of work up in Prince Edward Island, Canada, and cook at a lot of festivals there. And the butcher, it's a very small town. If you ever have the opportunity, it's like going back in the 50s, beautiful place. We cooked skirt steak fajitas. And when I ordered it, the butcher told the guy that was organizing the festival that it was trash. It was trash steak. And we had people lined up on the street, man, just digging into the skirt steak. And the butcher personally called me like 3 weeks later, and he's like, I have to compliment you because I've never sold so much trash to my customers in my life. I'm sold out of skirt steak.
That's months, awesome.
Because everybody's coming in demanding it. So I think if you bring a little bit of awareness and get people over the learning curve, that's where you have a lot of fun. And that's kind of a bit of my mission, is not always the top cut, but how do you make something really humble even better?
That's fantastic. Well, Matt Moore, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brett. I appreciate it as always.
Our guest today was Matt Moore. He is the author of the book, A Southern Gentleman's Kitchen. You can find that on Amazon.com. Go pick it up. It's a fantastic looking book. I'm not a really big fan of cookbooks because they all sort of look the same. This one is awesome because it weaves in stories, great pictures, and the recipes are super easy, but they look awesome and they're delicious. So check it out, Amazon.com. You can find out more information about his book at mattmoore.com. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate it if you would give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you use to listen to the podcast, because that will help other people discover the podcast and that helps us out. And, you know, one of the best compliments you can give is just recommend the podcast to your friends. So until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.